Hey everybody, on this episode of the Comic Book Exchange, we're getting ready for the season 2 premiere of Lucifer on Fox coming up by breaking down volume 1 of the 2015 Lucifer series, Cold Heaven. Let's do it.
This is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
Hey everybody, look at that. Hey, Wednesday, 6 o'clock. Yeah, that can only mean one thing. It is time for the Comic Book Exchange here on Book Circle Online. This is the show where we break down all the comic books that you've ever wanted to read or have read, and we also talk to the creators involved in bringing them to your eyeballs. Sure. Why not?
Sure.
Can they bring them to your eyeballs, don't
sure.
they? There you go.
Yeah. That's how I receive my comics.
Through your eyes.
Through the eyes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm one of your hosts, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter at HappyGoJackie.
And I am another one of your hosts, Lex Michael. I'm all over social media at TheLexMichael.
And our other two cohorts, Joelle and Lucretia, they are on assignment, so they will not be with us this day.
They're breaking down. Lost in the Phantom Zone.
How? Yeah. Yeah, that Phantom Zone projector zapped them again.
Again. It's a recurring problem on Comic Book Exchange, the Fritzy Phantom Zone projector.
Yep. It may get one of us, two of us, sometimes maybe even, hopefully not three of us.
You're going to tune in live one week, empty chairs.
That's right. All our ghost voices got to be from the Phantom Zone. So as I said during the cold open, we're going to be breaking down the new Lucifer series, the 2015 version. They're written by Holly Black, drawn by Lee Garbin. Of course, Lucifer, if anybody watches TV, they know it's coming back for its second season on Fox.
So this was the first question I had, Frank, for you, knowing that this was just going to be the two of us, and I tend to defer whenever possible to your endlessly encyclopedic knowledge of, dare I say, all things.
Oh my goodness, Lex.
Wanted to ask, is this a show that you are watching? Are you watching Lucifer? Are you keeping up with it?
I have not watched a single episode of Lucifer.
Nor have I.
Yes.
But what I've gathered based on all of the material from the show and associated with the show that I have seen is that this story arc that we're going to be discussing today is not really that.
No, I mean, certainly the Lucifer TV series takes more of, the devil, Satan, Lucifer. He comes to Los Angeles and gets involved in more police procedurals for various reasons, I'd imagine.
Somebody compared it to Castle, basically like Satanic Castle.
Yeah, I think it was Lucretia, because I think everything in her life at some point revolves around Castle.
That does. That sounds very much like something Lucretia would say.
Yes. If you could tie it either to the Castle or to John Constantine in particular. That's what Lucretia will do.
But he does get involved in investigations of a sort, which is similar to this story that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're basically looking at somebody doing an investigation, but certainly the scope of it is much more grand than you'd see in the TV series.
Yeah, maybe now you could do it on like an HBO, because they're doing a lot of really impressive stuff on Game of Thrones in terms of epic scale. Mm-hmm. You could maybe do something. I know they're doing American Gods now on Stars, right? So maybe we're now at a point where you could do this on TV. You're not going to see something this grandiose on a network, probably.
Very true. To back up everybody, if you've not read Lucifer or watched the TV series, just a little background knowledge for you. This version of Lucifer, certainly Satan has been involved in all different sorts of stories since the comic book medium was invented. For this particular one, this version of Lucifer, he was, I guess, kind of based on the John Milton Paradise Lost by Neil Gaiman, first premiered in Sandman number 5 back in 1989.
Yeah, and it's fun to see little bits of that mythology creeping over into this story.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like, too, like he's hanging out with Gabriel, who is, I believe, was a Hellblazer character. Was he not? Was this version of Gabriel not present in the Hellblazer series?
I'm sure it must have been, yes.
And then seeing seeing Cain and Abel make an appearance. And yes. I remember like this specific iteration of Cain and Abel from other books. I recently reread Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, and there's the very same incarnation of Cain and Abel show up in the underworld there. So that was fun for me.
Yeah, and so it basically shows up at number 5, and that's when Dream goes to hell and ends up getting into a debate with Lucifer and ends up defeating him, kind of tricking him. Lucifer, his own game, is able to leave hell. But then basically just says, hey, guess what, hell? This is a terrible job you have. And eventually Lucifer comes back to Dream and gives him the keys to hell and says, you're right. This job stinks. I hate being just thought of as the devil. And the preconceived notions that people have of the devil. I'm more than that.
It's tough because the better you are at your job, the worse you are by reputation.
Yeah. He ends up abdicating his throne, gives it over to Dream, and then he just takes off. And you very see the power vacuum that resides within hell. And that became like the jumping off point for the Vertigo series that Mike Carey did. And he wrote that for 75 issues as well. Interesting. Yes. The original Sandman went 75 issues. Lucifer went 75 issues as well.
And if I'm not mistaken, there's a fairly definitive capper when you get to the end of that series, correct?
Yeah, where you find that hell is not, wasn't supposed to be like a punishment, but a blessing, because you're further away, you're completely very removed away from God, so you're able to, you know, do your own thing and not be under his, like, his strict purview. So perhaps looking at it a different way is looking at, instead of it as a punishment, look at it as a gift.
Okay, interesting. And I know, too, there weren't many lingering plot threads left, as I understand it. And that's, I think, very interesting, too, because you tend not to see these very long, ongoing series that have endings. You know what I mean? That have mm-hmm. definitive endings. You tend not to. Typically, when a series runs long enough, it's just going to keep going until the universe it's a part of gets completely rebooted. And then you don't get that clear resolution that it seems like we got there. And so what was the genesis of this story?
I mean, for this, it feels like, well, hey, we have a TV series coming out. We should do some kind of comic book that's kind of related to it. Why not? If we're actually having something that's going to get maybe people watching the series be interested in finding out a little bit more about the character, let's go and get them to the comic book shops, have them something to read.
So very much a smart corporate synergy angle.
Why not? Yeah. So this one, as I mentioned, Holly Black, Lee Garbett. Lee Garbett, really cool. I liked his art style for this.
He, if I'm not mistaken here, I believe he also recently did Loki, Agent of Asgard.
Yep.
And a lot of that style, I'm reading this book, not having read that one, going, oh, I can very easily see this style lending itself perfectly to that type of story.
And they're very much like, I feel like in terms of, I don't know, I can't say influences because I pretty much assume they're contemporaries, but like Olivier Coipel.
Okay.
Who's done like the Spider, the big Spider universe crossover there. He's worked on some Avengers issues. He worked on the House of M crossover series.
Yep.
So a lot of similarities in their art style for this. But this basically just, it starts off where at the end of the original Lucifer run, he's basically left heaven and earth and the cosmos behind, and he's off in his own little area and ends up kind of experiencing what happens outside of creation.
Okay, so it's important, too, to know, like, going into this story, so you had a lot of this background information before you started reading this story, yes?
Yeah, pretty much everything we've talked about is pretty much the extent of what I've known about Lucifer. So in terms of, like, the nuts and bolts and some of these characters that get introduced or reintroduced in this story, I'm like, okay, sure.
Okay, so have you read the 75-issue original series?
You know, it's one of those where it's like I tried to read some of it because I did like Sandman.
Yes.
And certainly the storylines that Lucifer was in, I was like, oh, yeah, those are intriguing stories and stuff. And I tried to read the original Mike Carey run, and I was like, it's like a series that I feel like I should want to read, and I tried, and I just couldn't get into it.
Okay, interesting. So you're similar to me in that our actual hands-on personal experience with this version of the Lucifer character, pretty limited. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to figure out where we both lay as far as that was concerned before we started talking about the story itself, because this story is bananas.
It is.
It is bananas in a lot of ways that I really, really enjoyed, but there were a number of places throughout the story where I felt like there was context I was missing, and I wasn't sure how much of that was intentional and how much of that was there's 75 issues worth of story and character information that I don't have.
Yeah, and I feel like there's like two ways when you approach a book like this. If you're rebooting something that, you know, has already kind of reached its own resolution, you're continuing the adventures of a story that of a character that may have reached some kind of definitive sort of conclusion. Do you just kind of branch off in your own direction? Do you just have to acknowledge all the past that came with it? I mean, you could do something like Daredevil when Mark Waid took over. I mean, certainly he'd been like that grim and gritty, depressed Daredevil character. And then Mark Waid took over and said, like, hey, what? You know, I'm just going to be a nice guy. I'm just going to be happier disposition, and kind of just broke off and went in his own direction, which I enjoyed that. It was just like, you know, the past did happen, but I'm focusing more on just being more positive, happy-go-lucky guy.
Yeah, I felt like when I was reading the story, I mean, and I think they do a very good job telling their story. Again, the story that is just, it's bonkers, but... But I was with it. I was never lost because they're telling the story in a very accessible way. But I always felt like I was at a bit of a remove from it. And I think it's just because I was missing a personal connection to these characters. Because when you jump into the story immediately, you're dealing with a set of players who are on the board in a certain arrangement. And they're all familiar with each other. They're all familiar with their position. And they're all familiar with how they got there and why. And this story doesn't really spend much time filling you in if you don't already know.
Yeah, and I wonder, for that I often wonder, it's like, if you've read the original 75 series, boy, you're really going to be excited to jump back in and see these characters again. But I feel like, if for people who haven't, does your story need to be more new reader friendly? Do you want to be able to be more inclusive, or you're like, no, guys, hopefully I can write this in such a way that you're going to be intrigued by what I have to say, and you're just going to, you know, jump on board and stay along for the ride?
So maybe we come back to, when once we finish breaking this story down, maybe we come back to at the end the question of whether, for the two of us, what we read, not having that additional context, did what we read entice the two of us to maybe come back and continue following the story?
Ah, I like that idea. I'll be curious to see what our answers are.
So having that question now hanging in the air above us,
yes.
Shall we dive in?
Let's do it. Yes. So certainly our first issue there, this is a 6-issue storyline broken down in volume 1, Cold Heaven. And we basically have Lucifer. He's come back from wherever he was at the end of the 75-issue run. He's been off kind of outside of creation, has some kind of altercation, and has now fallen back instead of, you know, fallen from somewhat the heavens, I guess. He's fallen back down to earth, so to speak.
That's falling from heaven is part of his shtick.
Yeah, that's his shtick, yeah. That's me. I'm always falling from something. That's it. And he opens up another club. Originally it was called the Lux. Now this is called the X-Lux. So
that's a name.
Sure, yeah, that is a name. Yeah, I guess. And interesting, like, when the devil comes to town, strange things start to happen.
I like the way... You see little hints of it, because we don't spend much time with Lucifer on Earth. Like, we see the club and we see the occasional impact of his presence, but a lot of the time we're dealing with some other plane of existence when we're hanging out with Lucifer. But I do like occasionally the small ways in which he wields his ability to influence or manipulate or get under the skin of somebody else.
You know, as we started talking about this, and we're talking about influencing and manipulating people. When you read something like this, I mean, I feel like the immediate connection you kind of make is you comparing Lucifer to John Constantine. You know, two people kind of operating in this sort of realm. They both are manipulative. They both will do stuff. I guess the difference between maybe like Lucifer, he will be he was always honest. He never lies. That's a aspect of this character. He will never lie. He'll let you lead yourself to hell, but he will always tell you the truth.
Well, it's also interesting that you reference Constantine specifically, because also the style, the very aesthetic style of this version of Lucifer is Constantine-esque. There's a moment where you see Lucifer wearing a coat and a hat, and because of the universe that this book is set in, I actually did a double take at the page to make sure it was not John Constantine that I was seeing.
Yeah, in fact, when he was first introduced in Sandman number 5, Neil Gaiman was very specific that he wanted to have him very Bowie-esque. Kind of look. And so there are times with John Constantine where I feel very much like a Bowie sort of kind of connection too.
Well, and Constantine, right, originally I believe the design influence for Constantine was Sting, which is pretty close. I mean, the marks are similar.
We got our Sting. So basically, if only we could have had Sting and Bowie doing our Constantine Lucifer crossover.
Dude, DC's still figuring out what movies they can make. Like, it's not too late. We could do like a Velvet Goldmine DC Dark Universe movie. You'd see, don't laugh, you would see it. You'd pay money. You would pay money to see that.
I think it'd be tough to get Bowie involved in this. But he'd be the toughest get. He'd be the toughest get on this one, I think. But we do have Lucifer comes back to Earth, starts his nightclub up again, and he's back. And we just see how all of a sudden everybody realizes, oh, goodness, hey, we thought Lucifer was gone. Wait, he's back. And if he's back, that can't be good for anybody.
Generally, no. Generally, Satan is bad news for anybody but Satanists. And oftentimes, Satanists as well.
Yeah.
As it turns out.
Yeah, wait, man, when we get to this, the story at the end of this volume, I was like, what? But then we also have another character that, and as coming into this as a new reader, as you were, the Angel Gabriel, who has gone through a variety of trials and tribulations, many that I guess are just informing us here, but I don't have any greater context for because I didn't read those original stories.
Again, and I want to say I read an interview with the creators where they referenced this iteration of Gabriel originating in Hellblazer, but there's another one was like a big, it's like a shame, a secret shame of mine. It's like a big iconic series that I have not fully delved into yet. Hellblazer is another one.
Yeah,
I don't know the specific incarnation of Gabriel, but like Lucifer, it does seem like there's a lot of history that exists that we could go find if we had only known.
That's true. And I feel, as we mentioned there, when Gabriel does confront Lucifer, he does bring up, like, hey, you're forgetting there was also, you know, Constantine and other people involved in everything that went wrong with you. So don't just be blaming me for all your troubles.
Right.
So yeah, so him being in Hellblazer makes perfect sense that that's where those original stories of what happened to Gabriel would be found out. But we see him; he's hanging out in Newark, New Jersey, just hanging out in a flop house, you know. And then he gets visited from a couple of angels there, saying, "Hey, man, we know you've been disgraced. You know, you've been cast out. You're human now, but you know, we're going to give you a chance. We need your help, and only you can do this for us."
Yeah, what I like too is that, again, we don't know exactly what the textual relationship between everybody is, but we get enough information to know that the relationship among the angels, Lucifer included, certainly contentious, and whatever happened, there's no love lost between Lucifer and Gabriel, so this becomes a very personal grievance of his.
And I feel like amongst, I can't imagine there's any angel that is, I mean, I guess if you think about it, doesn't have something against Lucifer for what he's done and being the first of the fallen.
And also, he's just got no qualms whatsoever about screwing everybody over. He doesn't even have to get anything out of it. He just really enjoys being duplicitous. So yeah, probably no love lost between Lucifer and any of his siblings at this point.
And if you think with Lucifer and the DC universe and the way they treat both heaven and hell, and I guess that has also shades of Preacher, if we're talking about that in terms of the structure of heaven and hell. In terms of like the heaven side, there seems to always be like some kind of power struggle, some kind of order, pecking order things, and people are, you know, worried about like, oh, we can't cross this person because they are more powerful than us. There's always seems to be like some sort of pecking order. Do you like that interpretation of heaven where there is petty squabblings amongst the angels and all that?
Well, it's certainly more interesting than everybody's nice all the time and no one ever has problems or conflict. Like, I know if there is a heaven, which version I'd rather live in. Mm. I'd rather live in that everything's great, no problems, everyone gets along, we play rugby on Thursdays, and it's like the nicest, softest rugby you've ever played. Everyone's gentle. Like, that heaven sounds much less stressful. But it goes back to the Greek myths, right? Where the gods, yes, they're gods, but they are subject to the same human foibles as the rest of us. And I think that's what makes it, that's what creates the drama. That's what makes it an interesting story. And I also, you referred to this power dynamic where it's not just obviously the power dynamics within heaven itself or within hell separately. You've got these two directly opposing forces, and it's pure evil and pure good that are constantly fighting for supremacy, right? But that balance is what we all experience. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, that constant push-pull, that really aggressive, specific, tight push-pull between good and evil is where we are existing right now. The idea that tension always exists, like fault lines that are pushing against each other, and if one gets the slight advantage over the other, it could be potentially disastrous. That's great. That's a fun concept for a story. Again, seems really stressful. Wouldn't want to live in that version of heaven.
Yeah.
But I like it.
Well, it seems like, if you think about, like, hopefully, I mean, ideally is that certainly the angel is more subject to the human foibles, as you mentioned, but hopefully God is above all that. But then if you look at hell, you've got Lucifer, basically that he is an angel, so subject to all the same human foibles. So not really an exact counterbalance if you're looking at terms of the two far ends of the spectrum.
But I also think, too, Lucifer has he makes no pretense about what he is. He accepts himself fully, and that's just like, yes, I am subject to the same, we're going to use the word foibles again because it's just a fun word. I am subject to the same foibles, but I own it. It's fantastic. And I think that's, if you're not in hell as a prisoner and you're not being tortured and you're a denizen of hell, I feel like you are more inclined to just go like, yeah, I'm terrible, but I own it. Whereas if you're in heaven and you're a version of an angel, say, that is like the Greek god version of one of these heavenly characters, more than likely you've got a certain, as depicted, these characters often have a greater sense of pride, a greater sense of like, yeah, I am, they're open to these same weaknesses, these same follies, but they delude themselves about it, and their egos often cloud that and cloud their perception of it, and that tends to create even more drama for these people.
What I like is interesting, and I have not read the original Lucifer series, so I don't know if that's something that continued or something they've kind of added to this. The angels all have different sort of wing structure and design, which I thought was kind of a nice little flourish than your traditional, what you picture as angelic wings.
Yeah, this was something else that I thought was cool that I would like to see explored somewhere else. And I don't know, maybe they did this in the original Lucifer series, but I like the idea of wings maybe as it's a piece of equipment, essentially, that you could switch out. We see Lucifer attach wings to Gabriel later, so presumably you could switch out your wings, you could upgrade them, you know, like a piece of technology. But also, is it strictly technological, or is it representative of a hierarchy, perhaps, because you always hear in different, you know, in these mythologies about a hierarchy of angels. Could the wing design maybe denote somebody's ranking?
True, yeah, or reflecting a part of your personality or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But we find out that there are a couple angels that come to retrieve Gabriel. They want him to do that mission. They bring him back up to heaven, and they show him the throne of the presence, as he's known, you know, Yahweh, God, whoever you may describe him, but it is the presence.
And I like the presence, though. I like this idea that his name is such an omnipotent. Like, yes, he's all things to all people. He's a presence.
He's a presence. Yeah. They bring him inside the throne room, and you find out that there is like a hole through the throne. And when you look through that, it looks appear to be the presence, whatever, it looks to be dead through that. I'm curious to see exactly what that means as you're looking through. I was trying to understand how that scene was laying out. So he's looking through the hole where we see you're basically seeing through something, but I couldn't quite tell like what he was seeing.
No, I was not really sure what was going on at this point, other than he's looking for something that isn't that, like, we're meant to understand what he's looking at clearly, because you're like, here, look at this. What am I looking at?
Yeah. He sees something that is not good. Whether he's actually looking through that hole and it's giving him entry into a different dimension or a different aspect of heaven where he can see the presence and it seems to be immobile, perhaps dead, or what? Or the fact that he's just looking through and he can just see through the chair finally because there's no presence there blocking it.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, is God supposed to be in there? And if so, is the implication that whenever somebody has to commune directly with God, they have to, like, hello, they have to, like, put their eye on the little thing and they have to hope they don't catch God in a weirdly compromising position? That seems like an awkward system. But maybe it is. Like, maybe the presence is supposed to be on the chair. And it's like, look in that hole. What am I looking for? Well, I don't see anything. You're not supposed to see the hole! And then...
Oh, that's bad. And we find out he's been summoned by Metatron. He is the Chancellor of Heaven. Nice little title there.
Yeah.
And basically says, hey, the presence is... he's gone. He may be dead. We need to find out who did this. And we don't want anybody else to know. Of course, that's always a big thing. You don't want anybody else to know that the God presence is not in play anymore, because that's a big thing.
No, once your leader is gone, that's a power vacuum that literally everybody in heaven and hell is going to be scrambling to fill.
And so they figure, well, let's get you, Gabriel. You're a fallen angel. You're on Earth. Nobody's going to really think about you being involved in this investigation. You do this. You find out who's done it. We'll give you back your wings. We'll give you back your angelic status.
Sure.
Seemed like a good deal.
As deals go, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd want to know who, if I was an angel, fallen or no, I'd be at least intellectually curious who killed God.
Yes. And he's also from his, whatever the exact storyline happened with Hellblazer and his adventures with John Constantine and Lucifer, Gabriel did lose his heart in the course of that encounter.
So he walks around with this big, what looks like this open hole in his chest.
Yeah. So that was the other part of the deal. We'll give you back your heart too. So who doesn't want a heart?
You know what? Clearly he can live without it. I'd be more concerned about the cavity. Like, what if a possum nests in there or something? He's a vagrant, essentially. So, yeah. Like, you know, I don't know. Possums might be a problem.
Always wear a shirt. That's why you always wear a shirt.
You always write, and he walks around with the hole and no top on for a good portion of the story.
But he also gives him, Metatron gives him a really cool flaming sword.
Right. Like, the biggest perk probably to being Metatron is the access, the constant access to flaming swords that you can just hand out to all your friends. Yeah.
And I thought this was going to be, I thought seeing that scene, that the rest of the 6 issues was going to lead out to them, Lucifer and Gabriel eventually going at cross purposes until they finally meet, like maybe at issue 5 or so, and then they have their big battle. Nope, we get right to it.
No, this becomes like a buddy cop story pretty quickly.
Yeah. I mean, Gabriel shows up at the bar and says, like, hey, I'm ready to start whipping some ass. And you are target number one, Lucifer.
which I suppose it does stand to reason. And obviously they've got their own personal beef. But if something happens to God, I suppose it is reasonable to assume that the devil himself may be a suspect, at the very least, worth talking to.
Very true. I mean, and I feel like that as Lucifer himself, I mean, you can't deny that you should be on that suspect list. You may not have done it, but you've got to understand why people would want to talk to you about such a thing.
Right. And if anything, if I'm Lucifer and somebody else does in God, I'm going, wait, that was supposed to be me.
Yeah.
That you took my whole thing. That was like my whole... Oh, yeah. Dude, bro, what's... No.
No one's going to... No one's, yeah, it's like, yeah, you don't beat up my dad. Only I can beat up my dad. Yeah,
but it's like a whole... I'm picturing like a whole page of just little box panels, and it's Lucifer just standing there, sullen face going, ah. Yeah. Just word bubbles with like weird, like, yeah, like N-Y-E-E-E-A-H. Ah.
We do find that, as we see during his battle with Gabriel, that, I mean, he can get cut, he can get hurt, he can bleed, and he's in a weakened state. In fact, we see it when he first crash lands Earth. We do see a big wound on his lower abdomen there.
Lucifer.
Yes, Lucifer. Yes. We find out, like, during his time when he left creation, he ended up being in a battle with someone that happened to have his same kind of face, thought he was fighting himself, and stabbed him with some kind of weird black metallic kind of oily ever-shifting thing.
This weird knife blade that breaks off in him, but almost seems like it is, if not sentient, if it doesn't have a specific agenda, it certainly seems alive.
Yes, and as Heath says, it's just working its way towards my cold heart.
So of course, this becomes, I would argue, becomes Lucifer's primary motivation in getting involved in this. It's not actually to figure out who killed God, but to figure out how to get this weird morphing dagger out of himself and save himself.
Yeah, I figured that the easiest thing to do is you construct yourself a suit of armor with, you know, with a core right there that'll help keep those metallic shards away from your heart. Right? Isn't that what you do in these situations?
That's how the familiar solution.
Yeah,
I believe.
You put an arc reactor in your chest and you keep that stuff away.
Are you sure that's not an old wives' tale?
I don't know. It seems like I think it's science. It seems a very reliable way to protect yourself.
It sounds pretty sciencey.
So, of course, Lucifer and Gabriel say, all right, we both seem to want the same thing. I want to be able to, only I was supposed to kill my dad. You want to find out who killed him. Let's work out together. Let's do this. Let's have a buddy team up and find out who did this. So, of course, I didn't realize that Lucifer's blood was flammable, which is interesting, where you can just light it on fire and start seeing things.
But, you know, now that I know that, I'd be disappointed if that weren't the case.
Yeah.
I never knew I wanted this. I never knew I wanted a swaggering Lucifer with flammable blood. And now I genuinely can't imagine fully embracing any version of the character whose blood doesn't ignite.
One other character that we do meet back when the angels first come to get Gabriel is somebody else that's in that flophouse is this gentleman, this kid, like 15 years old. His name is Lauren. He's kind of a runaway and a drifter himself.
Yeah, Lauren, whose presence in this story makes, to me, absolutely no sense until a certain point when it makes complete sense, but that happens fairly late.
Yeah, I feel like his addition to the story, as we'll see in later, because he's pretty much just brought up here, and then we don't see him again until later on in this original 6-issue story arc. I feel like he's a character that's set up for future story arcs. But it's interesting, like his introduction here, just like, he doesn't really amount much to anything in this whole story arc.
We don't really know what he's there for. We cut to this bus station where he's leaving town, and that's it. We don't really know why. We don't know who this guy is. We don't know where he's leaving, really. We don't know what he's going towards, really. We just know that he's doing it.
And that he has one feather from one of the angels.
From Raphael.
Yes. So he's got that with him. And it's kind of giving him some kind of compulsion, some kind of, like, he knows he needs to go somewhere. He just doesn't know exactly where.
Right.
But his girlfriend just not like, get out of here.
Yeah, that's a scene that I think will read a whole lot better if I go back to this and I read it again with full context. Of course, I understand exactly why we're seeing this moment now. First time through, I was like, what?
Yeah. And we find out as we were saying that when people start finding out that Lucifer's back in town, back down in hell, we have Lady Mazikeen. She is now sitting on the throne of hell. She's queen of hell. Where she's just nailed right in, like basically like, almost like crucified into the throne.
May I say, I really enjoy the design of this character.
Very interesting, yeah. And I guess she was his consort in the original series and is the daughter of Lilith, as we see during the course of these issues.
Yes.
But now she is just kind of, the circumstances that led her to having the throne of hell, it certainly doesn't seem like something that she can willingly abdicate. It seems like she's pretty much stuck there until something else changes.
Yeah, and this is also something else interesting that I wasn't really considering actively while I was reading it, but now that we're talking about it, like, so they go back to hell and somebody else is on Lucifer's throne. Okay, well, we know he abdicated willingly, but then we see on Earth he's running a nightclub, but he's not really, it's there and he's in and out. We don't really see much of the goings on there. This version of Lucifer, at least in this story, feels very, very detached from everything.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't really seem to have any, there's nowhere for him to plant his feet. You know what I mean?
And I'm wondering if that's a case of him, you know, being off on his original 75-issue run. He kind of reached his apex, and now when you come back down, if you think your story's kind of done and over, where do you fit in? Maybe that's kind of tying into that, where, like, you're trying to find your place amongst all these things.
And it also feels like even Lucifer, who, yes, you could argue as depicted classically, like, he's evil. I mean, it's literally the devil, you know? And you can argue that, I guess, like, yes, that is that is enough of an agenda. But even as depicted in many, many other works of fiction, it's like, okay, I rule hell. I want to topple heaven and reign over earth, but I'm going to do it by taking hell and, like, making everything else hell. So, you know, with hell comes Lucifer, comes his army, comes, you know, he's got a base. Mm-hmm. This version feels so untethered from everything that it seems a lot of the time, he's obviously, yes, he's working in service of himself, but it he feels not agendaless because he's amusing himself, but it almost seems like he's doing things, he's going through motions to see what will happen.
True, because I feel like his main motivation for originally abdicating is that he was just tired of being, you know, just having those preconceived notions that everybody had of the devil. It's like, you know, I'm just not this. I'm more than this. And so you feel like, yeah, all right, but, you know, what is he actually doing now that he's kind of abdicated all this?
And it's not, I don't want to say it, like, it's not a criticism necessarily, and it fits very much in with the very dreamlike tone, very dreamlike aesthetic, the very dreamlike pacing of a lot of the hell sequences where we're with Lucifer and Gabriel. I think, tell me if you disagree, the other storyline that we're following on Earth with Azazel in a jar, mm-hmm. I think that moves a lot more, and I think it's because it's clear at all times, even before you know the demon in the jar is Azazel, it's clear at all times who everybody is, what they're doing, what they want. And you don't get that really with Lucifer. Lucifer's mostly reacting to things and going like, "Well, what happens if I do this?"
True, because I think as we're talking about, we're just about bring up Azazel in a jar. Is that I think anytime you just have some kind of demonic looking creatures inside a jar whispering, you know, like murderous thoughts, like wanting you to kind of like to enable you to do these things that might be in your subconscious. Like, you can pretty much tell. It sets the stakes really well. I mean, other than Lucifer, you don't know what his agenda is. Is he trying to be a good guy? Is he trying to be a good guy? What does he want? This is pretty clear-cut. Like, this is a demon trying to influence a human to do terrible things.
Right, and I do really like this incarnation of Lucifer. Again, this is not like a damning criticism that I'm making. It just feels like it lacks a certain focus. Like, and Azazel is probably maybe the most proactive character in these six issues, even inside the jar. He's mm-hmm. at least we know what his goal is. His goal is to get out of the jar. And we're watching him do it. We're watching him try. We watch him fail. We watch him try again. But then you also have the supporting cast where it's maybe because it's characters that are not beholden to all of this additional backstory and context. But I also feel like the other characters that we spend time with, their goals become immediately clear. And what they need to do to get where they're trying to go becomes immediately more clear.
Yeah. So as we're talking about, we find out basically in Oklahoma, the school teacher who his mother passed away, who happened to buy just lots of stuff at, like, knick-knack shops, thrift stores, garage sales, and stuff like that, now that they've passed on, you know, her sister is like, all right, you go clean this all up, and if you find any cool stuff, you know, share it with me. But she goes through the house and ends up her parents just happen to find what we think appears to be a demon in a jar.
A demon with a bunch of 100 little faces.
Yes.
That start whispering things. I'm wondering where they acquired this.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, just like somewhere in Oklahoma, they're just going through like a little yard sale. Like, oh, hey, this looks cute. Really?
All right. Is there a string of dead bodies behind this jar? Like, if you trace back who had the jar before, what horrible things befell them that it ended up in this pile of stuff where they could acquire it?
True. And you know, that makes you wonder then what happened to her parents then. Like, certainly nothing good could have came from having this jar full of smiling, weird, creepy things. And we see it starts influencing her. She goes and she ends up stabbing her old high school boyfriend who left her for another girl.
So this is maybe hysterical is not the right word because it is so very, very dark. But obviously, we've talked about how Azazel is trying to influence people and he wants to get out of the jar and presumably he wants to get out of the jar to do very bad things. So he starts whispering to this woman. This woman has, it's her old... The guy that she was dating
in high school.
It was her best friend, and they ended up together. Yeah. And now she talks about. We actually spend time with this idea about how this relationship meant a lot to me. I miss my best friend. Like, I wasn't even worried about him past a certain point. I just really miss her, and it's a little tough to see him together like this. And we're actually getting inside her frame of mind, and we're dealing with very, very recognizable emotions: regret and loss, and you're being sad that relationships didn't work out the way you hoped they would. And this whole time, Azazel's whispering into her ear, like, let me out so I can, you know, we're going to do some things. And it's going to be great. I'm not going to do anything terrible. I swear, just let me out of the jar. And she gets pushed to a point where, you know, we knew Azazel was going to do something terrible. She snaps, kills them under Azazel's influence herself, and Azazel's like, man...
Yeah, I wanted to do
man,
that.
Man, you're supposed to let me out, and I was supposed to get to stab them. And the way this is executed, conceptually, it is just so darn bleak. Yes. The way it is executed, I found genuinely hilarious.
It's interesting. I found myself enjoying more of that storyline than I was enjoying Lucifer and Gabriel's story.
Well, and it's what I was saying before. The Lucifer and Gabriel story has a lot of stuff going on in it that I really like. A bunch of really strong individual elements. But because it feels a little bit less goal-driven and it's already so ethereal and dreamlike, there's just not a lot that's easy to hook into immediately. Whereas this, like we were talking about, it feels a lot more immediately grounded. It's set in our world. We know what the stakes are for these people. We know what Azazel's doing. And yeah, it moves. Because of that, it moves.
Yeah. We do find out, while this is happening in Oklahoma, Lucifer and Gabriel, of course, your first step is trying to figure out, you know, who may have killed God, is like, hey, let's go to hell. And because there's a lot of people down there in hell, not just me, that would hate God.
Sure.
Good suspect list. So they go down there. Not the warmest of receptions back there, as you would imagine. But we found out Lucifer's boy Beelzebub. He's been kind of, you know, trying to fight and keep hell in Satan's in Lucifer's name.
I like that there's this like what almost looks like a squabbling board of directors running yes. hell in Lucifer's absence. This is what it looks like. And I also like that their different names are different nicknames for Satan in different. Iconographic, is that a word?
They are, yeah, I guess, theologic?
Different theologic, different mythological interpretations of Satan mm-hmm. and the nicknames that you find in these different interpretations. I love that the members of the board are all, it's like, Beelzebub.
And we find out, Gabriel, he doesn't have a great time down there. We basically see a lot of this. He keeps getting tortured through a lot of the story, whether it be through demons flaying all his skin off, whether it be crows in the dream realm pecking away at his eyes.
Some real awful stuff happens to him almost immediately. Yeah.
Your entire body gets flayed, and you're lowered into a flaming pit. Not a great way to be spending your time there in hell.
Also worth mentioning, super violent in its depiction. I mean, we actually get a big image of a bird pecking out Gabriel's eye,
yeah.
and it really got me because, again, like we talked about how this artist who drew like Loki, Agent of Asgard, this feels like a superhero book, the way it's drawn. You don't get imagery like some dude's eye being pulled out of its socket by a bird while he screams in your average Marvel book. You know what I mean?
Very true.
So you'll be flipping through and the imagery will be commensurate with something like that. And then all of a sudden you'll get this like, oh my goodness. And you'll remember what book you're reading.
Well, they finally make their way to the, of course, to the throne of hell. And so they are talking, and they find out, hey, you don't want me. You want to talk to my mother. And even though she's dead, a part of her may exist in the dream realm. So why don't you go to the dream realm, see if she can give you any more information about where the sword and the owner of the sword may be, or where it originated from, give you an idea of where to be able to track it down.
Right, but the dream realm where it's not like they're super popular.
No, they're not super popular there. And while they're getting ready to head over that, we go back to Oklahoma to find out our other one story is Medjine Parker.
Yes.
She from Haiti and then was adopted by this family in the States. Her and her brother were separated. They're supposed to be adopted together, get separated. So he's in New Jersey with the family. She's out here in Oklahoma with another one. And they are not what she thought were nice people, but man, what a bunch of jerks.
Horrible.
Yes.
I mean, horrible. They don't treat her like a person, which then makes me wonder, why did you agree to take this kid in anyway? But you get they're very it's the religious, very wholesome, very upright type of family, but as posturing. You know what I mean? Like they're certainly not as good as they I think maybe they actually believe that they are, but they're actually just tremendously unkind, very, very nasty people.
You know, even the mother says, like, oh, I thought she was going to be younger, but now she's like, you know, she's almost like a woman. She may start tempting our son's hearts
I was
and
like,
stuff like
that. Whoa,
ugh,
dude.
All right, great. So basically, her life in this family is not depicted very well. And we're seeing this kind of intercut where they go, Gabriel and Lucifer go to the dreaming. They find Lilith, and she starts telling them the story of Azazel and what happened with him. And you find out that his deal was that he would take all the sins of this town if they put him on a goat, and then he would eat the goat and eat their sins.
Eat the goat, yes. And we get some of the imagery associated with that as well. It's nuts.
Yeah, and I guess like anything like this, I feel like you can see that coming, is that he gets so addicted to all this sin that he keeps trying to like make that sin like, I guess, sweeter and sweeter or richer and richer. So he keeps getting, enticing the villagers to do more and more terrible things.
To just behave in the most outlandish ways possible. Like the imagery we get as they're talking about what Azazel does, we're getting this imagery that tells a story. Like as a, for example, and it's a woman who comes in and clearly sees what I guess we're meant to assume is her husband sleeping with another woman.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, so obviously we, Azazel would push them to behave a little bit more extremely, and then he'd push him even further, and then you see the three of them
yes.
making love at the same time. But then Azazel pushes them even further, and you see this next little piece without specific, we're not lampshading it, yeah. but homeboy has been stabbed to death by the two women who are now being confronted with other people. But it's Azazel's not nice.
No, we figure out that the villagers, the way they get back, is like, we're going to send one lady to seduce him, so to speak, get pregnant, hopefully have his child, and then we can use a part of him to kill him. That seems to make sense. How do you kill an angel? Use something of himself to kill himself.
You know, I don't have a better idea.
No. So she seduces him, has twins. One is kind of a very happy-go-lucky kid. The other one's kind of dark and sullen. And as they get of age, they kill the sullen kid, Caleb.
Yes, that's right.
And Nathan is then given a sword that is partially forged through the blood of his twin brother. And says, hey, guess what? You have to go and kill your father with the sword because he's just a terrible, terrible being.
Oh, man.
And he does. And then, but as he gets killed, Azazel realizes, oh, this is my son. I'm going to just project all my essence, my powers into him. In a sense, Nathan becomes Azazel and goes back and just kills the whole village.
It's a lot of stuff happening here.
Yeah.
And a lot of this information is given in a very condensed frame. I mean, this is not, we don't get all of this information over multiple issues. A lot of this is in a couple of pages.
No, it's Lilith does a big exposition dump right there in the dreaming, which is like, all right, cool.
But you really have to be, I mean, if you're a comic book reader, hopefully your brain does this. Your brain, I think, past a certain point starts reading the words and the images as one. But you really got to be actively reading both the text on the page and absorbing and interpreting the imagery, or you're only going to be getting about 50% of the information, especially when it's all so condensed like this.
And you find out after he's killed everybody in that village that God says, hey, guess what? You got to get rid of this guy. So they bury him under rocks.
Go figure.
Yeah. And until he has no flesh left. And then he eventually is released out of there. But the sword that he had that he used to kill the original Azazel still exists. And that's what Lucifer figures out. That's what was used to stab me.
Yes. Also, another instance of skin removal, which is a big deal in this comic.
Don't get so used to your skin, because you're probably not going to have it very long if you're hanging around with these people.
Yeah, a lot of people getting flayed.
Yeah, that's a go-to, right, with these guys. And then we figure out our two storylines there of our two, Metagene and as well as our teacher, they kind of intersect as the part of the family is going around doing door-to-door kind of proselytizing. They go to that door where the teacher has just killed her pals.
Man.
And now they're sitting in there going, oh, all right, now what do we do?
This is straight up horrifying. This scene is far, in my opinion, far more horrifying than anything we see in Hell or anywhere else.
And you were again right with the way that this is drawn. It has such a bright, poppy, superheroic feel that just to see the actions that are taken drawn like this, you're like, ugh. It seems more disturbing than if it had drawn more in a traditional kind of Vertigo-esque style.
Well, let's not bury the lead. I mean, this lady is still stab happy, and she just straight up stabs a little boy.
Yes.
On the couch.
Man. Oof.
Like, out of nowhere, stabs a little boy. Again, if you let yourself relax for a page, you're going to be ripped violently right out of that.
I agree with you. That seems like more of the disturbing part of the story. Like, whoa, they just killed that kid right there. Okay, he's dead. And then we found Metagene. She stops the teacher. She threatens to break the jar that has Azazel inside it.
Yes.
And of course, the cops start coming. So the teacher just cuts her own throat. Like, oh, looks like I shouldn't have listened to that demon. Cuts her own throat. That's it.
I mean, we've all been there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we've all been there. But instead, we see that Minogene is taking the jar home with her. And not so much that she's going to be influenced by what it has to say, but she doesn't want anybody else to be, perhaps, find that jar and get influenced and do terrible things.
This was the one. There are a couple of things that she does that maybe on the surface are a little questionable, but I understood every single one of them from her point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how she knew. Well, I mean, the thing was talking to her, but I don't understand how she was so confident that she could take it and keep it from other people, and it's not a horrible idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just because she had been raised with a family member that would say horrible, awful things, and so she's used to being talked to like that and having terrible things said to her, so she felt like, oh, I'm used to this, I could deal with it.
Right, I get it, but then I accept it because she's very young, and that does seem a bit like kid logic, which is like, oh, my skin, I got very thick skin. I can handle whatever this literal demon in a jar is going to throw at me.
Yeah. But we find out that, no, that seems a little different to think that, yeah. Demons are one thing, like a terrible family member, same thing. Your drunk uncle. I don't know. It seems a little less stakes than they've got like a demon in a jar. Like, hey, come on, let's do some stuff.
But also, okay, so speaking of these terrible people, they're of course, they have to double down on their terribleness, and they find a way in their minds to hold Mei-Jun responsible for what happens to the little boy.
Yeah, it's like, because she, like, oh, whatever was inside her went and possessed his teacher, because that teacher was really nice until then, so we're going to do an exorcism on her. Like, what? So she's like, I'm out. She gets in touch with the brother and says, which I did like. There was no drama or anything about that. My brother said, hey, you get to me. Yeah, you can stay here forever. It's great. We'll make it work.
Yeah, and they had, so they weren't supposed to get separated they went into the system. They weren't supposed to get separated, but they got separated. And it seems like her brother is doing pretty okay. Like, he ended up somewhere that's all right. Whereas she is basically treated like prisoner is stretching it, but not by much. She's basically like the way the Dursleys treated Harry Potter before all the wizard stuff happened.
So while she's on the run trying to make her way to her brother in New Jersey, we finally get Lucifer and Gabriel, and Lucifer's getting weaker and weaker by the moment, but they do finally make it to this place there in the dreaming where he happens to come across another version of his wings, which they've kind of, I guess they say, they kind of grew from like a feather that he left behind from his original set that had been cut off.
Which, again, like we were talking about the wings before, and this is one of the only times where we really we focus on the wings as a concept, but again, something that we both said we'd like to see explored a little bit more somewhere.
Yeah,
possibly. This is a cool idea.
And we found out for the dreaming that there are some of the creatures in the hell-like aspects that will use the dreaming as a kind of like a backdoor way into putting people through hell or torment is the use of dreams. So it's kind of a backdoor illicit way. You're not really supposed to do that, because if Dream knew that you're doing that, he would not look kindly upon it. So Lucifer feels like, hey, at least I'm not going to say anything. She's probably not going to say anything. Just give me my wings back. Let me just go use the dreaming to get back into reality.
Yes.
Seemed like a good plan. And he gets some wings on the bargain for Gabriel.
Sure. Well, that's something else that I really like, too, is that we see him literally sewing the wings onto Gabriel's back, which surprisingly works.
Yeah.
Actually, he works great. He says that he's just tired of carrying Gabriel around everywhere, because in the amount of punishment that Gabriel has taken past a certain point, he was not quite as able as Lucifer to get himself from place to place.
And we find that they make their way back to reality, but we also find that Lauren and Mei-Jun, they kind of reunite, they kind of come, their paths cross at the bus station, they're riding a bus, and then all of a sudden, Lucifer and Gabriel, they show up on that same bus. Because they know that Azazel is, it's not really a demon inside that jar, it is now just the essence of the angel that has been just feasting on people's sins throughout the years. It was within that jar. So it's kind of basically just a corrupt angel, not necessarily a demon, I would say.
Sure, although one could argue that's more of a semantics thing.
Very true.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Lauren, for his only role in the story, then cracks, snaps that one wing, or one feather.
Which apparently is like, that's like the magic Raphael glow stick, and he just suddenly knows where to be, and he's there.
Yes, so Raphael shows up, and then it goes a little bit to town. They start fighting each other, and
we get like a cool like flaming sword fight.
Yeah, not too bad. And then we find out, really, as Lucifer, always working on multiple levels, when he's approaching some kind of idea or some kind of task that he wants to accomplish, he usually has ulterior motives. And the idea is like, hey, this piece of metal that's still within me, it was forged to create, to kill Azazel. And now we're so close to Azazel, you don't want to be me. You want to be killing this thing, your original purpose. So it shoots out of Lucifer and into Azazel and destroys Azazel before he can say anything that he knows about who may have killed God.
Yes, but before we even get there, literally my favorite thing in this entire story is Azazel... When Lucifer says, you know, this is a terrible demon, we gotta, you know, basically trying to appeal to her logically, Azazel's like, no, this is literally the devil.
Yeah.
Like, who are you gonna listen to? Like, yeah, maybe I'm not that nice, but this is literally the devil. And he literally has the line of, well, it's better the devil you know, right? And I can't necessarily fault Mei-Jun at this point for going, well, like, it's literally, maybe she bought that's the literal devil pretty quickly, but opens the jar, lets him out. I like that moment a lot, because that seemed like kid brain.
Yeah, and a lot of like, you're trying to use like genie kind of rules with this. Like, I let you out, you have to do whatever I say, right? Yep, okay, you're right. I got to.
Yeah, and he actually has to do it.
Yes.
And he realizes like, oh,
I can't just eat you. I want to eat you. And I can't eat any. I can't harm any living thing. Great. All right, Lucifer, you do it. You kill her, please. But then we find out that Lucifer, Gabriel's mad at Lucifer. You were just doing this because you want to get the shard out of you, and this is how you knew. This is why. This is a way for you to get that done. And then Lucifer says, "Hey, I know who really killed God, and it was you. You're the one. You held. You had. You were. You look like me. I noticed a little throat slit, a scar of a throat slit, a scar on your throat where it kind of been slit during our encounter with this doppelganger of mine. And you want somebody changed, erased your memories of you killing God."
Yeah. And I felt a little like Gabriel in that moment.
Yes. Like, huh? So I killed God and I don't remember it. And I guess we find out that his mind, he'd been, I guess his heavenly angelic powers have been restored, because that's why he was able to heal so quickly through all these things that we've seen, his skin being flayed, eye being plucked, everything like that by the ravens.
So, yes, Lucifer points out, well, yeah, didn't it seem a little odd to you how quickly you heal for a human? And maybe it would have if I had this entire story, I was never thinking of Gabriel as strictly, he's got a hole in his chest, you know what I mean? I never really thought of him in those terms, so I didn't really consider the fact that it was odd that he was healing so quickly.
No, I just assume, like, you know, sure, he's mortal, but I felt like kind of angelic mortal, where he can a little bit more of a faster healing ability than a regular human or something.
I figure he's still maybe not like Wolverine, but like Wolverine light.
Yes, exactly. I didn't realize that he had been corrupted in such a fashion that he had his powers but not his memory.
But this was apparently a very big deal.
Yeah, and so now that he doesn't know who's done it, he tries to go up up to heaven, try to accuse them, like, no, we didn't do it, it was you. So he goes back down to hell. And we find out that he's told when he was hell that he's going to come back, because that's where his heart's going to lead. And he comes back and he says, "I will give you my service if you just help me find out who is the one responsible for this." And so they say, "All right, that we've got a deal." They seal the deal, and then his wings turn from angelic wings into like a crow wing.
It looks very like big and black, and yeah. he does. He looks like a little bit like a James O'Barr drawing.
So yeah, so that's where we kind of leave these guys, and then just we have Metagene. She makes it to her brother in New Jersey, and they're just hiding out in his closet. She doesn't know how long she's going to last because, I mean, 13 now. She has to be 18 to be kind of her own adult, so that's 5 years. It's kind of a very melancholy ending, and I don't know. I guess we'll have to keep reading the series to see if she comes back, but it seems like a really kind of melancholy way to leave her in the story.
There's not really an ending here to any of these threads, but we do get, in lieu of an ending, we get these stopping points, these temporary stopping points that are mostly bummers.
Yeah. And then Lauren, of course, as we mentioned, like, he is saying that an angel wants him for something else, but we really don't. Hopefully, in further issues, his reason for being in the story is addressed.
Because again, I feel like if he's only in the story to snap the feather and get Raphael there, I feel like there's another way we could have gotten him there without this entirely separate character.
It felt like so weird to have that kind of like a dangling thread, like, okay, what's that all about? I guess kind of like the danger of reading this as a trade, but you kind of think this is a kind of a storyline complete in and of itself. So you think that any of the characters at least would come to somewhat of a resolution. You may not be happy about it, and there may be more story to tell, but at least for the moment you have kind of a ending with that character. But that brings us to the end of those first six issues of Lucifer. There was a little backstory as well, too, which we're probably not going to get a chance to delve into. Just suffice it to say, this is Son of the Morning, and it is a twisted, twisted story.
I actually really enjoyed that. Might be my favorite single issue of the six that we read.
Yes.
But also, it feels the most self-contained. I felt the least lost.
Yeah, it's just a really perverse story, so I'm curious to see. It would make me want to read this series more, just to see where this intersects with this story. The main Lucifer story and this storyline that's introduced in here, they kind of intersect, because it's a twisted tale on Satanists. All right. Satanists, hey, man, Satanists are just like us.
Indeed.
Yeah, I feel like that's what I thought. Like, hey, these are cool Satanists to hang out with these guys, for sure.
Sure,
why not? Yeah. So, all right, as we're wrapping up, quickly to address the question that Lex posed at the beginning of this episode, we've read these six issues. Has what we read here enticed you to continue on with this series?
So, yes and no, because there is some stuff stylistically about the way the story is told that I absolutely love. I love how much of a noir detective buddy story, at least this arc was for half of it. I really like a lot of the ethereal dream imagery. I really like how, yes, the violence is very much intended to shock, but it was incredibly effective in the way that it punched up the scenes that it took. Because we talked about how superhero-y the book looks in its general art aesthetic. The shocking moments of violence are genuinely, powerfully, uncomfortably shocking, and that I was very impressed by. I really liked a lot of the characters. I would like to see a couple of them be a little bit more proactive, Lucifer in particular. Yeah, I'd like to spend more time in this world, but maybe if I was going to keep going, I would need to know that I'm going to get some clarity on some of this mythology pretty soon, because I got enough of it to never be completely lost at sea, but I never felt like I was totally keyed into the story, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for me, it's like I think if I were to continue with this, it'd probably just be in trades. I would not probably want to do this by singles. I'll do a trade and like maybe read like another six issue chunk. I think I'll give volume 2 of this trade another shot, and then that'll probably be like the tipping point of deciding if I want to continue with the series or not.
For sure, especially when there are so many characters, the mythology is so dense. I feel like for me personally, reading month to month, I would be completely lost. I feel like I would need to do a couple at once, and that's not a damning remark. I just feel like if I was going to continue, that would be the way for me to absorb this most efficiently.
That is going to do it for us here on the Comic Book Exchange, as we broke down Lucifer, Volume 1 of the 2015 edition, A Cold Heaven. Now, folks, we're going to be back next week as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. are coming back for their Season 4 premiere, September 20th. We're going to be here breaking down the Jim Steranko classic S.H.I.E.L.D. issues. If you're a digital comics reader, they are available right now on Comixology. They're doing a big Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. volume sale. You can get that whole Steranko collection for $3.99. on Comixology right now. So certainly a fantastic deal. I think that's over 15 to 20 issues of comics.
Dang.
All in total for $3.99. How can you go wrong there?
Nice.
So do yourselves a favor. Grab that. In the meantime, then, you guys can like us on Facebook. Give us those 5 stars on iTunes. Hop on the YouTube channel. Subscribe to that. Lucretia will be back here next week. She'll have her computer, as we always like to say, she is our oracle.
Indeed.
So she'll be able to open up the chat. You guys can comment about what you thought about the Steranko issues or anything else that's on your mind in terms of comic books. And we'll be back next week to break down on Jim Steranko's S.H.I.E.L.D. run. In the meantime, though, if you want to continue the conversation with us, even off the air, Lex Michael, where can they find you?
You can find me all over social media at TheLexMichael. Frank, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at HappyGoJackie, and we'll see you next week right here on the Comic Book Exchange. Bye, guys.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO, join the circle.